First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the show. I'm not even going to introduce this week's guest because he needs no introduction. Bill Walton.
Wake up to find out that you, Bill Simmons, are the eyes of the world. And what could be better than to be rocking out on your podcast? Hi, everybody. My name's Bill Walton, and I work for Bill Simmons.
Well, this is an honor because... You know, well, not only did you own Kareem, who was my least favorite NBA
player. You've lost your mind already.
We're going to get to that.
Kareem was absolutely the greatest. I had the privilege, Bill Simmons, of just a week ago presenting, enshrining Kareem Abdul-Jabbar into the new NABC Basketball Hall of Fame in Kansas City, whatever state they're in over there. I can't figure
Missouri.
That part out. But it was amazing because when Kareem asked me to do that, I didn't even think he knew my name, because why would Kareem know my name or anybody else? Because when Kareem retired in 1989, at the age of 42, there was no NCAA player who ever had done more, no high school player who ever had a better career, and no NBA player who had ever scored more points, blocked more shots, won more MVP awards, played in more All-Star games, or logged more seasons. No player in the history of basketball ever achieved as much individual and team success as did Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And the only thing you can say about my career was that I'm the most injured player in the history of basketball.
Do you know why he asked you? Because he was like, who was that guy who used to routinely kill me every time I played? I think I'm going to ask him.
No.
Who was the guy who destroyed me?
I played my absolute best against Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Every bit of my career was focused on beating this guy. All the weight training, all the hiking the John Muir Trail, running up and down the beaches of California, riding my bike from Oregon to the Mexican border, and the whole time I'm telling myself, Jabbar, I'm going to get this guy. And I'm just so fired up, I'd go out on the court. And I did play my absolute best against him, Bill. But that guy, he was so good. He threw 50 in my face every single time. That guy's left leg belongs in the Smithsonian.
First of all, that's not true because you outplayed him in the 77 playoffs and in 86.
Are you in some sort of time warp?
No, and in 86,
so phenomenal.
When you joined the 86 Celtics and you pushed them over the top and turned them into the greatest NBA team who ever played.
That Celtics squad was so wonderful. It was terrific in so many fronts. We had all the players. And when you talk about great teams, I was privileged, Bill, in that I was on three of the great teams in basketball history. The UCLA Bruins with Johnny Wooden, whose records still stand to this very day 37 years ago after we got to Westwood. The Portland Trail Blazers, where I played my best basketball for Jack Ramsey, who made me the best player that I ever was. And that was the youngest team in the history of the NBA to ever win the championship. And then the Boston Celtics, my boyhood dream team. Because even though I'm from the heart of Laker country in Southern California with Chick Hearn and Jerry West and Elgin Baylor and Wilt and Dale Goodrich and all the guys, I was a Celtic. Bill Russell, my favorite player ever on and off the court. Red Auerbach, the patriarch, the guy that put it all together. Even though I'm adamantly opposed to smoking of all kinds, when Red Auerbach would light up that victory cigar. Little Billy Walton from San Diego, California, with his red hair, his big nose, his freckles, his goofy, nerdy-looking face, and his horrendous speech impediment, being the stutterer, stammerer, spitter, and stumbler that I am, would jump up and down and say, go Celtics, go! Go Celtics, go! And when you talk about the characteristics of all those great teams, Bill, you think about communication. You think about getting the message across. You think about the leadership of having the great players. You think about the commitment to the team. You think about who can deliver peak performance on command. But what you really think, the guys at the top, I played for the two very best. John Wooden and Red Auerbach, the patriarchs who put the teams together. But they realized that it was based on people. And John Wooden, who really analyzed this thing with that quirky, funky, silly little pyramid of success. I mean, come on. Who would have ever thought that things like industriousness and enthusiasm and friendship, loyalty, cooperation, intentness, initiative, alertness, self-control, physical fitness, skill development, commitment to the team, poise, confidence, competitive greatness, flanked by faith and patience would have anything to do with anything, but it's the people involved. And when you're talking about guys like Jamal Wilkes, Greg Lee, Henry Bibby, Larry Farmer, Larry Holyfield, Marcus Johnson, Dave Meyer, Sven Nader at UCLA, you're talking about Maurice Lucas, the greatest teammate that I ever had with the Portland Trail Blazers, Lionel Hollins, Johnny Davis, Bob Gross. You're talking about that Celtic squad, Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, Robert Parrish, Dennis Johnson, God bless him, we miss him, what a tragic loss, Danny Ainge, who's now finally out of his coma and actually running things in the ball. There. And then you got on the bench, you got Rick Carlisle, Jerry Seasting, Scott Wedman, Greg Kite, David Thirdkill, Sam Vincent, who's also a head coach now, and those people are what make it all happen. And
Wait, I had to say something.
At the end of the day, we had Larry Bird.
Yes, you did.
Who was unquestionably the greatest player that I ever played.
Hold on, we're going to get to him.
Okay.
But when the 86 Celtics, going in that season, the year before, Kareem had destroyed them in the finals. And the reason they lost in 85 was because, really, Kareem just took it to another level. You come in in 86, you beat him twice in the regular season, basically because one of the reasons was because you outplayed Kareem in those two games. And then the Lakers have the gall to lose to the Rockets in the Western Finals and not show up for their beating in the finals.
Have you lost your mind? Do they do drug testing at ESPN? What's up with you? I mean, you must have a really good contract over there. This is absolutely incredible. But the
they
Celtics
you.
Lost in 85.
They Celtics- ducked you. They ducked you for the rematch.
The Celtics lost in 80 for Kareem, Magic, Worthy, Wilkes, Riley. They never ducked anybody.
They wanted
that
no part of that 86
team. And the reason the Celtics lost in 85 was that Cedric Maxwell sadly had a knee surgery. And it was very tough because at the end of that season when I called up Red and asked him if I could become a member of the team. He looked across the table during this phone conversation that I'm having from Club Red in San Diego, where I've lived for the last 29 years on the north edge of Balboa Park. And I'm asking Red, please, can I be on the Celtics? And he said, hold on a second, Walton. So he puts his hand over the phone. I learned this story later, is that he looks across. He's having a meeting with Larry about what to do next with the team. And so Red says to Larry, Walton's on the phone, and he wants to be a Celtic. What do you think? And Larry looked back at Red and said, go get him. And
nice.
So I begged, I pleaded, I ultimately bought my way on the team, and I can never thank Larry, the Celtics, Red, the people of New England, not for giving me my career back. They gave me my life back.
And that was the most fun you ever had, playing basketball.
No, because you can never compare children, concerts, coaches, championships. It's all the same. Whenever you're on a great team, it's all so perfect. And that's what you live for. And I think it's sad to me that the players, and as our world has changed, when you look, Bill, at the pyramid of success, that which I thought when I was playing for Coach Wooden was the absolutely most ludicrous thing ever, but now I live my life by it. Our house is a shrine to not only Jerry Garcia, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, but it's also a shrine to John Wooden. We got the pyramids everywhere. We got him, his pictures leering at us from every corner of the house. But when you're part of something special, it changes your life, and you spend the rest of your life chasing that down. And the bottom block, the fulcrum of the pyramid, is loyalty. And loyalty, Bill, is defined as the human quality and personal characteristics that enables people to accomplish extraordinary things because they care. And sadly, our world has now become one of mercenaries, has now become one where money trumps all. And it's just so very, very sad, because when you look at the state of our game right now, and in no particular order, just some rambling thoughts that are flashing across the smoking crater that's my mind, you've got the structure of youth sports, which is just way too organized, and young people never get a chance to just figure things out for themselves. You get the lack of respect for coaches, officials, and authority at a very early age, the complete misappropriation of the teaching of fundamentals in basketball, the free throw shooting, the shooting in general, the footwork, and our world is just sadly too focused on the spectacular highlights as opposed to the core fundamentals of the game. And at Michael Jordan's adult basketball camp in Las Vegas a year or so ago, I asked Michael, how much time did you spend practicing fundamentals versus practicing the spectacular play. And he said, I never practiced 1 second on the spectacular. It was all physical fitness, skill development, and commitment to the team. And then you got the impact of the three-point line, how that's changed everything. Players don't go to college or put any emphasis on education. There's no focus on the mental training. The effects of the year-round nature of the game, which I think is just too much. The players get beaten down, worn down in anything that requires creative imagination. You have to have a down period. You have to have a break where you sit there and you say to yourself, okay, whew, exhale. What am I doing with my life? Where am I going? Then you have a world where hype is more important than substance, and self-promotion and individual direction of the game is just absolutely unappealing to the fans who are looking for the team game all the time. And sports are sadly overcoached and undertaught now, and overthought and underplayed. And the playground experience, which we all learned the game as a youth, that's almost non-existent now. Everything is organized with refs and parents, and oh, it's just absolutely too much with these traveling teams, and there's always games. There's never real practice out there. And the fact that the emphasis on the size and the strength and not just on the skill and the balance and the quickness, the most beautiful aspects of the game. I can remember when Coach Wooden, Bill, would always tell us, he would say, now remember, man, basketball is like life. It's not a game of size and strength. It's a game of skill, timing, and positioning. It's not how big you are. It's how big you play. It's not how high you jump. It's where you are and when you jump. And so while he's telling us all this stuff, Bill, I'm sitting there scratching my head. I'm saying, wait a second, Wooden, how can you tell us that it's not a game of size and strength when Kareem has all the records, Shaq has all the money, and Wilt has 20,000 girlfriends? What is up with that? And he would come right back, because I've never met anybody who was more prepared, more totally involved with the anticipation of what was going to be next. And he said, Walton, you're the slowest learner that I've ever had, because don't you realize that it's not about material accumulation? It's not about physical gratification. It's about training the mind to learn how to learn, to learn how to think, how to dream, how to philosophize, how to analyze, so that you can win not one possession, not one trip up and down the court, not one half, not one game, but every single day. And you do that by subjugating the ego to the greater goals of the team.
And that's almost impossible, because like when you were playing in the 70s, and I think the Magic and Bird era in the 80s, the unselfishness was actually like a cool trait to have. And I think Jordan was the guy who changed that. And it wasn't something he did intentionally.
He didn't change it intentionally, no, because Michael represents the perfection of everything that went before, from Oscar to Kareem to Russell to Wilt to Jerry to Walt Frazier to Dr. J to Larry and Magic.
Right.
And then here's Michael, who lives it all and comes together with this most remarkable harmonic convergence of the city of Chicago, the explosion of cable television, the explosion of Nike onto the marketplace, and now everybody starts thinking that it's about shoes, that it's about hype, that it's about commercials.
But yeah, you become
Michael
a company.
Jordan, this guy was the hardest working guy. He was the most committed team player. He was the best at everything. He was the best at dribbling. He was the best at rebounding. He was the best at defense. He was the best at passing. He was the best at shooting. He was the best at leadership. It was absolutely phenomenal what he did. And then, sadly, his legacy gets lost, because now everybody wants to play their whole career the way Michael played the last few ticks of the shot clock. And that's not how you do it. I was actually going to
bring that up, because I think the phrase I use is the hero complex. And you see this at the end of every quarter and every game, where everybody has to clear out and the guy has to be the hero. And what usually happens is they end up taking a bad 20-footer with a hand in their face.
Now,
but that's how MJ
David
did
Halberstam's,
it.
Bill, you have to read David Halberstam's last book. It's called Coldest Winter. And while it's ostensibly about the Korean War, it's really about our country and where it was, where it has been, and where it's going. And it is the most important and inspirational and educational book, I think, that I've ever read. This is not a book about Britney Spears. This is not a book about O.J. Simpson. This is not a book about how America is falling apart because of the rise and possibility of same-sex marriage. No, no, no. This is important stuff about everything that went down. And here is Michael Jordan out there trying to get the right message across. And the world has changed. The game has changed to where you have a scenario where it used to be, think Magic Johnson, who was such a brilliant leader, such a fantastic communicator with those big bug eyes of his, and that ball just an extension of his mind. And he's out there figuring out, the way Steve Nash does today, okay, how do I make these guys the star? Now, he had star players. He had Kareem. He had Wilkes. He had Norm Nixon. He had James Worthy. He had Bob McAdoo. He had Byron Scott. Steve Nash, he has Amari Stoudemire, and now Grant Hill, and what a great story that is. But when you watch most basketball, it's whoever has the ball is dribbling for themselves. And you have nine other guys standing around. Now, I got drawn into the game of basketball because of Chick Hearn, who on the Laker broadcast, growing up as a child, we didn't have a television, but I had a little AM radio that cost $9.99, and it was unbelievable. You had those little transistor batteries that you used to test on your tongue to see if you still had a little bit of longevity left into it. But Chick would just make it so exciting and so fun, and he taught us how to think and how to dream and how to play basketball. And then Johnny Wooden's UCLA teams with Gale Goodrich and Walt Hazard and Kenny Washington and Freddie Gauss and just all these phenomenal players. And then to go on to the King Kareem, who came out. The King Kareem 29 times on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And now all of a sudden, you watch these games and you have far too much specialization. You have far too many guys who can only do one thing out there and not enough sense of playing like Bill Russell or Magic Johnson or Steve Nash. How do I make the other guys the stars? And that's what we have to get back to. But sadly, our world is, you know, is really fallen into this culture of obedience where we find it easier to pay for war than we can finance healthcare or education. So I'm just trying to figure out all this stuff, and it's just swirling around. It's just unbelievable. That's why I'm so glad to be on your show and you can bring some clarity and some logic and some common sense to the world.
Don't you feel like the NBA? I mean, I agree with everything you said, but the NBA.
Don't ever do that. They'll come for you. You know.
No, I agree with all the points you made, but I think this particular NBA season, the league is in the best shape it's been in about 15 years, because not only do you have you have the stars that aren't trapped in bad situations anymore. They're actually on good teams and they're able to be stars. But also you have LeBron, who through the first month of the season has played every game with that Jordan-like intensity that we kept waiting for him to show. And now
LeBron
he's doing
is phenomenal.
It.
Yeah, and he's the doing best up there in Cleveland. LeBron is regularly putting up numbers and performances that have only been matched by the greatest players ever.
Right.
And people talking about LeBron maybe averaging a triple-double, while he's capable of it, I think the one guy who is more likely to do it is Baron Davis. Because, and Baron would have trouble with the rebounds the way that LeBron will have trouble with the assists, but it'll be easier for Baron because the volume of numbers in a Golden State game. And I don't know if you had a chance to see this remarkable game recently between Phoenix and Golden State.
It was last night.
I watched it. Absolutely brilliant to watch these guys racing up and down and jacking up threes. I mean, it was a dream come true as opposed to the plodding, looking over at the coach every time. I looked over. You know, I talk to Coach Wooden all the time. I call him all, you know, basically every day. He doesn't take my calls anymore because I bug him so much. But he told us every day, Bill, to never look over at the sidelines during the course of the game because there's nothing he could do for us anymore. But when you look at LeBron in that Cleveland situation, he's always so positive, never whining, never complaining, never making excuses. You look at the other great stories, Lakers, Celtics coming back up, and while people will think, oh, that's tremendous, and it is for the business of basketball, never forget that the NBA reached its greatest numbers and its greatest exposure and the huge number of viewers and sponsorships when it was Chicago with Jordan versus a good New York Knicks team. And during the 90s, when they just every single year record numbers, but now you have San Antonio, the best team in the West, Boston, the best team in the East, representing all the positive ideals. No hype, no self-promotion, no egos out of control, no individual issues or agendas. Just guys playing basketball for the fun, for the joy of the game and of the team. And you got Steve Nash, what's going on out there. And I'm always amazed at Steve Nash, who's my favorite individual player in today's game on and off the court. He's not the best player. Tim Duncan is the best player by far. And you know, but Steve, what makes him so remarkable is that here's a guy who's slow, short, and can't jump. And that is an extraordinary burden to try to carry in the world of basketball. But he gives everybody hope. And when we're talking about books, you got to read Studs Terkel's book, Hope Dies Last, because this is just this incredible tome about guys who have to battle through the remarkable adversity of life, and they never give up. And that's what Steve Nash has done, because here was a guy who wasn't thought of much in college basketball, certainly wasn't thought of at the high school level, and then all of a sudden he has taken over and working with the positive leadership of a Mike D'Antoni, and who has changed and really saved basketball. And I always think back, because I grew up in a remarkably positive, upbeat, and hopeful era where people thought that they had a chance. And while the dreams and the hopes of so many people today are just being crushed by the world that we have allowed to take over in our own social circles here, now you've got this all coming back. And when you see the negative coaches, the bullies, the thugs, the guys who teach through fear and intimidation and exclusion and a plutocracy. If I had ever played for one of those coaches as a youngster, I just would have quit. And so I just can never thank my first coaches and John Wooden, who were always under the umbrella, the imagination of how can we make our lives better? How can we make this world a better place? How can we use basketball to improve our own lot in life? And that's why I always encourage the young people to train their mind and not let basketball use them.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Nash, because I think that the effect that he has on that Suns team is similar to what you did for the Blazers. In the last 30 years, how many unselfish superstars do you think we've seen? Because I don't know if you could necessarily call Jordan unselfish. I think
yes. Jordan
was
unselfish in the nature that he never let anything get in the way of winning the game for his team. And when you're really great, you have to be selfish to some degree. And that's why the key is to remember, when you're talking about ego, it has to be ego under control, because ego is a good thing if used in a positive way. But if you have players who are out there only trying to accomplish individual goals, individual achievements, which I go back to the very first time Coach Wooden came to our family home in San Diego, where my parents have lived in that home in the hills east of San Diego for 55 years, and he came on a recruiting trip, and it was just absolutely incredible, because he said to me, he said, Bill, you're going to make the second most important choice of your entire life. The most important choice you'll ever make is who your lifelong partner will be. And I'm so fortunate in that I have married up in the world, and Lori, just the queen of everything, what an angel she is, standing in a shaft of light. But then Coach Wooden said, Bill, you got to make your choice as to where you go to college and what team you're going to be on, based not on what's going to happen with you, because you're going to be good enough, Bill, that it's going to come together for you. But how good are those people going to be right next to you? Because your ultimate level of success, happiness, accomplishment, and achievement in life is going to be based not on what you do, but on how good those teammates are. And that's why when I looked at Greg Lee and Jamal Wilkes and Larry Farmer and Larry Holyfield and Henry Bibby and Marcus Johnson and Dave Myers and all the guys, I said, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to go play in the history and the tradition and the legacy of UCLA with Johnny Wooden, and I want to be with those guys so we can run and jump and sweat and have the great press and the fast break, and oh, I just live for that. I just wish that more teams would run, and I see Golden State, I see Phoenix, I see Orlando, I see Boston getting up and down, and oh, the world of basketball has been saved, thank heavens.
Well, and you mentioned the coaches before. The league turned
into six of them that I played for that are in the Hall of Fame, and many more that would be, except these wretched legs of mine, which caused me to be the most injured player in the history of basketball. I played 14 seasons in the NBA, Bill, and I missed a grand total of 9.5 full seasons. In fact, when I went into the Basketball Hall of Fame, they told us we each had 5 minutes to say our thank yous, everybody. Well, at the 17-minute mark, I'd already learned how to talk a little bit. At the 17-minute mark of my 5 minutes of allotted time, the guy from the NBA there, who was there to monitor the situation, make sure that we got done in time so everybody could get to the bar, well, he jumps up mid-sentence, 17 minutes into my speech, said, come on, Walton, you're the most injured player ever. Let's wrap this thing up. Your speech has started to last longer than your career did.
Well, I was talking about the coaches that are now where you say they're kind of a little bit domineering and the guys have to look over to the bench to see. That stuff drives me crazy. That's why I love that Phoenix Golden State game last night, because it was a controlled chaos on both sides. The point guards were in charge. Everybody was doing their thing. The coaches were basically just watching and substituting, and that was it. And I just don't understand why more teams don't play that way.
I wish they all would. That's the most fun. Every player wants to play that way, but you got to be in shape and you got to have the skill. And one of the problems that we've had, and this is a societal problem, is that we have taken the decision-making out of young people's lives. You have to teach them, train them. And basketball is so much like rock music. And, you know, I can just remember back. I mean, we talked about the Celtics, and but the domination of Boston is the greatest sports city in the nation today. I was there, August 1987, Foxborough Stadium. It was absolutely unbelievable. The home of Nick Buoniconti and Gino Cappelletti and Jim Lee Hunt and Bob D and Babe Parilli and all the guys, and what a fantastic Patriot team that was. And on the stage at Foxborough Stadium, the Grateful Dead and Bob Dylan. And it was unbelievable because the Dead were out there first, and they were warming up and making sure it was all set. And then Jerry picked up that guitar, stepped up to his foot pedals, and started playing da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, the times they are a-changing. And Dylan comes right out and says, you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. And here we were, sitting there just out in the crowd, yelling, pounding our fist up in the air, saying, go, Jerry, go, Bob, give us more, take us on the magic ride. What a time that was. And now all these young people are growing up with no sense of hope, with no sense of a real chance, with no sense of joy and the optimism and the part of being a member of a special team and a meritocracy. You know, they've just been beaten down like the Knicks fans, and their hopes have just been crushed. And they're always taught, let somebody else make all the decisions. Look over here. We'll put you in a position. Hey, rock music, basketball, get down to the gym. Get that ball in your hand. The only thing you ever have to do is wait for that opening tip and then chase it up and down. And that's why I can never thank my friends in the Grateful Dead who have given me the most unbelievable drum collection in my house. We call it Hydra 2, with all the different instruments and all the different electronic apparatuses and the Pro Tools and the hookups and the fact that you can just get and immerse yourself in a world of creativity and imagination and dreaming of being a part of something so very special.
Well, and one more thing about the coaches. The thing that drives me nuts the last 2 minutes of the game is when they're calling these timeouts to set up plays, why do they practice? Like, why do you have to set up plays? What do you do during practice then?
That's what practice is supposed to be for, and the practice floor is the coach's laboratory. And Wooden would tell us, we never call timeout. Coach Wooden, in the 4 years I played for him, never called a timeout. He always felt that timeouts were an admission of defeat and would only allow the other team to regroup. It's get it going, up and down, and then celebrate the great.
The best part is these teams, we're going to call a timeout and set up a play. All right, you four guys stand on the side, and we'll give it to LeBron or Baron Davis, and he's just going to go one-on-one. You need a timeout to figure that out? That's what I don't get.
Get it inbound, and don't let the other team set up. Larry Bird was the absolute master at all of this. He was so phenomenal. He would demand the ball at the end of the game.
Yep.
And then he would go and tell the other team what the play was. But ultimately, in basketball, in music, in life, it comes down to decision making. You spend your whole life, Bill, mastering the fundamentals, memorizing all the possibilities, the permutations, the eventualities. And then you get out there and the game is on the line, life is in the balance, the fate of Western civilization is right there in the palm of your hand, and it's the decision you make. Because if you go out there with a predetermined, preconceived idea as to what you're going to do, when that obstacle, when that defender, when that adversity pops up in front of you in life, you're going to fail. You have to be able to make that on-the-spot decision, and that comes from training in practice. And you can't come in and just, okay, draw up a whole new play with 5 seconds to go and expect to go out there and hit the game winner. No. Because the games, they become memorized exhibitions of brilliance out there, and that's why Larry Bird was phenomenal. And I had the privilege of being in the Boston Garden when those fans who filled that place for 15 years in a row with never an empty seat. Now, the all-time record is the Blazers with 18 years. The Celtics have 15 years of consecutive sellouts, and the Bulls in the Jordan era have 13 years. But when you were in that Boston Garden when Larry was playing, and those fans would stand and chant in unison, Larry, 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 MVP, MVP, and the scoreboard is just bouncing and rocking, and the building is shaking to its foundations. And in the very first game I was ever on the Celtics, and they started to do that, and I was just shocked, because I had been in the Boston Garden with the Dead, and when they were just chanting, Jerry, Jerry. And then I, so I go up to Larry Bird, and during his first Celtic game that I was ever in there, and I said to him, Larry, you know, what are they chanting? Are they chanting Jerry, Jerry? And he looked at me, and he said, no, Walton, they're chanting my name, and you better get used to it. And that I did. And you talk about what a great teammate Larry was, because he was the most popular guy, just an icon, just an idol. So every company wanted him for sponsorship and endorsements and commercials, and particularly this one restaurant right next to the Garden. It was called
Scotch and Sirloin.
Yeah. And it was just fantastic. And so they were really on Larry to, you know, do a commercial for this restaurant. So Larry said, okay, I'll do the commercial. I said, how much is it going to cost? Because they were really worried. And Larry said, it's not going to cost you anything, but I'm going to tell you what you have to do. You have to feed my teammates all the time. All they have to do is leave the cash tip at the end of the night. Now, when they made the deal, little did they realize that Rick Carlisle would eat every single meal of the day there all season long. But after every game, the entire team would go in, and everybody with their families and their children, and everybody would have their own little table, and the food, the salad bar, and the seafood. Oh, what a time we had.
Well, that commercial's on YouTube, by the way.
Oh, man, Larry Bird was so fantastic.
Well, let me ask you this, since you brought up Larry Bird and the Dead. I always thought there were some similarities with that 86 team and the Dead, because the best parts of that 86 Celtics team was the way you guys freelanced together, and those were always the best things about the Dead show, too, when they would freelance and do their thing.
Without question. And so, you know, you've got the greatest improvisational dance band ever in the Grateful Dead, and then you've got this player, Larry Bird, who is just such a dreamer, such a visionary. And he had fantastic teammates, from Kevin, who was the second greatest low post player I ever played against. From
who was number one?
Kareem, unquestionably. And not even close.
I'll give you that one.
And then the Chief, who was just outstanding in every aspect of the game, plus his character, his personality. This is the Rock of Gibraltar on which you can build a church on. And then you had Dennis Johnson, who was just absolutely spectacular, and Danny Ainge, who Danny and I go back to when he was in high school from Eugene, Oregon, and Danny would come up to Portland on his days off from high school and hang outside the gym, the Jewish Community Center, where we practiced just outside of Portland, and he'd wait, and I'd come walking in, and Danny said, come on in, Danny, let's go, and he'd run up and down the court with us and play, and he was outstanding as a high school player playing with the world champion Portland Trailblazers. So, I mean, this guy could really play. And then we had Casey Jones, who was, without question, the most like John Wooden of any coach I ever played for, both on and off the court. Casey was absolutely fantastic. And his speeches, I mean, Wooden never gave speeches. He just talked over the fray. But Casey's speeches were just absolutely brilliant. We, you know, the rare times we lost, we always lost that season to the worst teams in the league. On the rare occasion that we did lose, Bill, Casey Jones, he would look at us and he'd say, man, I'm just too disgusted and disappointed. I don't even want to talk about this right now. Let's wait till tomorrow. Now go in that shower and wash that mess off yourself. And then he'd gather us together the next day, and he'd say, man, I was back at my room last night, and there it was. The phone rang. I was just trying to figure out what had happened to this, I thought, really good 86 Celtic team. And Bill Russell called on the phone. And Bill Russell told Casey Jones that night that he had watched the game on satellite television, and he was so embarrassed, so ashamed, that he wanted the Celtics' mailing address so that he could return his 13 championship, his 11 championship, excuse me. And then, after a short while, John Havlicek called, and John Havlicek had also seen the game on satellite television. He wanted to know how he could have his number removed from the rafters of the Boston Garden. And over the course of the night, everybody for the Celtic family, Celtic pride, they called in wanting to distance and disassociate themselves from our team. By this time, during this speech that Casey was giving us, tears, green and white tears, were streaming down our cheeks. The Celtic pride was right back. We'd go out and go on another 15 or 16 game winning streak on our way to the Celtic 16th championship, which sadly has not been bested.
That's true. Wait, hold on.
22 years, but this year the Celtics are back in the hunt. And
wait, hold on. We got to talk about 86 Celtics for 1 second. You won 67 games. You
and
lost
15.
I think all that out of those 15 games, I think 14 of them were like 500 teams or below.
Yes.
One loss at home the whole season.
We lost to the Portland Trailblazers.
Yeah, who actually were kind of a bad matchup for you guys because they were so athletic. It was
there
the
was
team
no
that was,
bad matchup.
No, but you know what I mean.
We just played awful. And
if there was
Jack
a team
Ramsey,
that was going to beat you.
Jack Ramsey was just on top of his game that night. He was coaching the Blazers still. And we were trounced by Jerome Kersey, Sam Bowie, and Steve Coulter, who just ran us off the court. The one loss, which is the best home record of any team for one season, and it was not even a close game. It was a 20-point blowout wire to wire.
Well, you finished 50-1 at home.
Well, we didn't lose any playoff games.
Right.
If
15-2
team,
in the playoffs.
If you're a good team, you should never lose a home game. If you're really good.
So then, game five, Ralph Sampson, that cheap shot artist, throws
that
a punch
awful.
At little 6-1 Jerry Seachton. You
that
tackle him. Then you go into game six. And Bird is about as fired up as he's ever been in his entire life.
Let me tell you the locker room.
I was at that
scenario.
Game. Yeah.
I got to tell you this. This was just incredible because the fans, I've never seen anything like this.
I was there, by the way.
I have been on some incredible teams in some big moments. But the fans, we could not get to the home game. We had to meet at the practice site out in Brookline at Hellenic College, and they bust us in under police guard. For our home game, the fans were surrounding the Boston Garden. We go out there. Larry's out on the court warming up, as he always did before the game. And he comes in. And this is an hour and a half before the game. And he looks around, and we're all on the floor stretching, getting ready, doing our push-ups, slap fighting, playing pepper with the ball and everything. And Larry looks around and says, guys, I was just out on the court. The fans, they are all in their seats right now, and they smell blood. They smell the blood of the Houston Rockets. But I tell you guys, if we don't deliver, they're going to want our blood. Now let's get going. And Larry went out and played his self-admitted greatest game ever. Bill, he was so hot. He was grabbing offensive rebounds underneath the basket, wide open, to just stick it right back in. He would eschew that and dribble out to the three-point line and hit fadeaway threes as he's running back down the other court. There was never a player like Larry Bird. And to be there, it was absolutely incredible. After the game was over, we had to leave the arena in a bus, and we're backing down. It's just the players. It's a wild scene. Everybody, the arena still surrounded by all the Celtic fans, and we're backing down the ramp at the old Boston Garden, and it's just the 12 players. It's Casey Jones, Chris Ford, Jimmy Rogers, and Red Auerbach. And everybody's talking and laughing and congratulating each other for the championship, and there was a lull, a moment of silence there, just like one breath, and Kevin McHale from the back of the bus with that big booming voice, he yells up to the front of the bus where Rick Carlisle was sitting. Now, Rick and Ralph Sampson had been college teammates at the University of Virginia.
Right.
And so Kevin yells out to Rick Carlisle, who we called Flip, because his feet are so big, it was Flippers. And so said, Flip, hey, I will never ask you again why you and Ralph never won a championship in Virginia. Oh, what a time that was. And then we all took the bus over to Casey Jones' restaurant there, the Tony Roma's out there in Farmington, and oh, did we have a good time. And,
well, I went to a lot of those games during that decade, and the only two times where the crowd literally wanted blood was that game because of Sampson, who was psyched out from the moment he walked out.
Absolutely.
And then the other game was the game that turned out to be the game where Bird stole the ball against the Pistons. But game five of the 87 Detroit series, when the game before there had been the fight with Bird and Lambeer and Mahorn, and the crowd, I'm still convinced to this day the crowd convinced Robert Parrish to punch Lambeer.
Okay,
telepathically, we were just willing it to happen, and it actually happened.
And when Red Auerbach spoke at the Chiefs' retirement ceremony, he listed off all the remarkable accomplishments and achievements of this Hall of Fame, top 50 player, just the anchor, the foundation of that great Celtic team and experience of the 80s. And Red looked over at Robert and said, Robert, we love you dearly, but I do want to tell you that I'm still really, really mad at you. And the crowd just goes, oh, man, this is Robert Parrish's retirement number, and Red's telling the world that he's mad at Robert Parrish. What's going on here? And Red looked over at Robert and said, I'm mad at you because when you hit Bill Laimbeer, you didn't hit him hard enough, and he was able to get back up. And the crowd erupted. It was absolutely incredible.
I got to ask you one more thing about the 86 Celtics team.
Yeah.
There was a game. It was the clinching game against Atlanta, Game 5. I think it was the Eastern Finals. And the team rolled off a 25-0 run, and the Hawks had to call three timeouts during it. And I still think to this day that was the greatest single stretch of basketball I've ever watched in my life.
It was perfection. It was up and down. And a real key performer in that run was Danny Ainge, who was just a brilliantly gifted athlete who had that energetic drive of a younger brother who just kind of drives you crazy all the time, but just so enthusiastic, so fired up all the time. And Danny was hitting threes and stealing the ball. And one time, the Atlanta Hawks got so frustrated, so depressed, because they were just getting pounded. And this was a really good Hawk team. I mean, that's right. How long ago this was, that Atlanta was actually a good team. But they had Dominique Wilkins, Tree Rollins, Kevin Willis, Doc Rivers, who's now coaching the Celtics, Reggie Theus, Mike Fratello, the great one, was coaching the team. They had the original big dog out there on the bench. Spud Webb was on the team. And there was a time that Kevin or Larry made some just phenomenal play right in Tree Rollins and Kevin Willis and Dominique's face and just sort of put it right through. And the Hawks just exasperated. They just gave up. And so I think it was Tree. It might have been Kevin Willis. They got the ball, took it out of bounds, and just threw it right at Larry or Kevin, whoever had just torched him. And everybody stopped thinking the referees were going to, like, okay, blow the whistle. We got to stop this altercation, this fight that's about to explode here. So everybody's standing there. But the referees never blew the whistle. So the ball is rolling down the court. So there's little Danny. Danny races down to the other end of the court, gets the ball, dribbles it all the way back up the court. While we're all still standing there waiting for the referees to restore order in the universe, Danny pulls up and hits another three, a dagger right in their face.
Then there was the other game in Milwaukee, the clinching game where you clinch the sweep. The sweep, and I think the Celts were up 10 points the last 4 seconds or whatever. And Bird, just for the hell of it, takes one last three from the corner.
Let me set it up here. because this was Larry Bird at his finest. We were already up 3-0. Again, Milwaukee was the second best team in the Eastern Conference. Don Nelson, Terry Cummings, Sidney Moncrief, Jack Sikma, all kinds of really good players. And we are torching them, and we're in Milwaukee, and the fans there at the old Mecca with the band, and just absolutely a spectacular scene, and Larry's on fire. And it comes down to the closing minutes of the game. And we have the game. We're in control. We have the ball, and we come up the court, but we still have to keep scoring because they're playing well. And so, the play is called. The ball goes to Larry out near midcourt, and we're just all moving around, and Larry just stops, and he holds the ball. And we're looking, come on, Larry, let's go. Move it around. We got to get going. The shot clock's running down. Larry just totally ignored us all, waited until the shot clock was at 2, turned, and fired a three-pointer from near half court. Bam, nothing but net. Now, Milwaukee comes right back down. They got to get going, so they score right away, and we come up, do the same thing. We're running the play, and it comes to Larry at half court again. He just stops and holds the ball. Come on, Larry, come on. He wasted the shot clock, gets to 2 again, and turns and makes another one from half court. He did that 4 straight times. 4 times in a row, half court three-pointers to win and ice the game. We swept the Milwaukee Bucks in the Eastern Conference Finals. We went on to win the championship, and I go running off the court, and I'm chanting, Larry Bird, Larry Bird, Larry Bird. What an incredible performer. But you know what? As great a player as Larry was, he's a better person. We love that guy. And we would always do everything to help Larry play. And that's what's sad to me about what I see sometimes on the bad teams. Because when you're on a good team, you just milk the hot hand until he just dries up and he's just exhausted. That's why Larry's back is so bad. His elbow was so bad. He needs all those surgeries. But when you're on a bad team and the guy gets hot, he gets frozen out. And it was just so sad to see the direction of basketball in a selfish matter when you see the brilliance of the Celtics, when you see the phenomenal nature of Magic and Kareem and Wilkes and Worthy all the time, and now with Steve Nash and the San Antonio Spurs, and hopefully that's the direction that the Celtics are going to be in, and they certainly appear to be moving in the right direction.
Well, here's my last question, and I'm asking you not as the player, but as the guy who's paid to analyze things on NBA, on the NBA for ESPN, and it's paid to be impartial.
I get paid to be a fan.
I'm gonna say you have to be impartial for this question.
I'm always impartial, nothing but the facts here.
Was the 86 Celtics the greatest team ever?
It was one of the greatest teams ever, and
you're not
going to
give them the best.
Any championship team, and I mean any of them, could always be considered that because when you're on the top of your game, who can really beat you? But when you look at the great teams ever, the ones that stand out in my mind, and I'm only 55 years old, so I don't go back to the pre-Russell days, but the Russell Celtic championship teams, Wilt's two teams with Philadelphia in 67, the Lakers in 72, the Knicks of the early 70s, and then the Lakers and the
Hold
Celtics.
Hold on, wait a second. You have to admit, the basketball that was played from Magic and Bird on versus the basketball that was played during the Russell era, I don't think there's any – you can't really compare the eras, can you?
Absolutely, yes.
But it was much more athletic. The game was much more athletic in the 80s. I just feel like you could put the 85 Lakers in 1962 and they would have blown everybody away.
Well, how could you say that? In 1962, those guys were all 8 years old. Who were playing against Bill Russell,
no, I'm saying he's a time
and
machine.
Elgin Baylor and Jerry West and Bob Pettit and Oscar Robertson? Come on.
He's a time machine, though. I'm just saying.
I only live in a time machine.
I think the game evolved and evolved and evolved, and then by about right around the time the 77 Blazers showed up, that was when basketball became what it is now. But if you watch the tapes of the 60s and the early 70s, it's a different type of game. I don't think it's quite the same as it is now.
And you're going to tell me, you're going to sit there, and it's a good thing you're on the other side of the country on a phone, because you're going to sit there and tell me that Bill Russell and Oscar Robertson and Wilt Chamberlain and Jerry West and Elgin Baylor couldn't play basketball? Are you
kidding? I'm not saying that. I'm saying they wouldn't be.
And let me just close on this one point.
Yeah.
Or I'll keep going. I mean,
well, no, we actually have to go.
My flight's not till tomorrow.
We have to go. We have like 2 minutes left.
Okay. We're at the NBA's all-time team celebration, Cleveland, 1997.
Right.
And it's a fantastic celebration. The NBA does it so right. And everybody's there. But the whole time, there's just nothing but functions, nothing but events. And everybody's just, you know, autographs, photographs, which is all good. That's all part of it. But nobody ever gets a chance to spend with the other guys until the very end. And just before the presentation at halftime, when Bob Costas read the whole list off, and it did it in such a classy, distinctive way, we're in this one room, and there's just 50 players. There's no handlers. There's no autograph seekers. There's no photographers. Not even David Stern is in this room. Just the 50 guys who the NBA said are the
Well, except for Maravich. Maravich wasn't there.
Maravich wasn't there, and Shaq chose not to go.
Great decision.
Well, that's a story for another day. And so we're sitting there, and everybody's having the time of their life. High fives, signing everybody's autograph book, you know, giving everybody hugs, tears all around. And over in the corner is Wilt and Michael Jordan. And they're sitting at a table arguing vociferously as to who the greatest player of all time was. And they're
really?
Back and forth. And just intense as can be. And we're just having a great time. Bill Russell and Kareem are smiling and signing autographs, taking photographs. That's how wonderful this all was. So now David Stern comes into the room. And he says, okay, guys, time to go. And then everybody starts gathering together and lining up. And Michael and Wilt are still going at it at this table over here. And so David finally says, come on, Wilt, Michael, we got to get going. And so they stand up. The conversation ends. And Wilt, who always has the last word in everything, Wilt looked down at Michael and said, Michael, just remember, when you played, they changed all the rules to make it easier for you to dominate. When I played, they changed all the rules to make it harder for me.
And
there was no retort, no comeback. Wilt Chamberlain, oh my gosh.
And then
we'll do a show on Wilt Chamberlain one day.
I'd love to do a show on the greatest players. I think that'd be fun. But you left out.
I had the privilege when I was in college at UCLA, 70 through 74. Wilt was on the Lakers, 69 through 74. His last 5 years in the NBA, four times in the NBA Finals. They were only able to win one title, but to see Wilt go head-to-head with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar courtside when I'm 17, 18, 19 years old, oh my gosh. And Wilt started up there the next time.
I want to talk about, because I think Wilt is unquestionably the most fascinating guy who's ever played in the league. And
check out his book. Wilt, yes. Just like any other black 7-foot millionaire that lives next door, should be required reading for everybody. Granted, it goes back to the 70s when he wrote it, but it is phenomenal, incredible, remarkable, so educational, along the lines, but different storyline of David Halberstam's The Coldest Winter.
And also, David Halberstam's The Breaks of the Game, which remains the greatest sports book ever.
You know what? That's the one. I'm David's biggest fan, and it was so sad when he passed last April. But that's the one I can't read.
You're in it. You're one of the main characters.
Close. It's too close. And every time I've tried to read it six or seven, and I've told David this, I tried to read it six or seven times, and every time I can't get past page two. It's just so sad because that was such a perfect team, and that was my life, and it all came crumbling down.
I want to talk about that because I had no idea you'd never read that book. We're going to have to wait until next month.
It's just too sad.
Really? Never read it? Not once?
I tried six, seven, eight times. I can't get past page two.
Wow. I think I've read it every year since 1982, at least once.
It's too close, and it's just, it was such a wonderful team and such a joyous time, and then it all came crumbling down. And all the things that made us such a special and perfect team as the youngest squad to ever win the championship.
Yeah.
And it was all right there for us, and then, bam, just disappeared, dusted.
And you were one of the reasons.
Oh.
No, but I mean,
Bill, we love you.
You left.
Have a great day, Bill.
Well, we got to talk about that the next time.
The next time. The name
you
of the show.
You left for reasons that were legitimate reasons.
We'll get into that the next time.
We'll get into that the next time. Can you read the book before we talk the next time?
I'll try.
You can't do it?
I will try.
Try to get to like page 50.
I will try.
You will try. All right. In the meantime.
No greater storyteller. You know, I have been blessed to know people like David Halberstam, Dick Enberg. Oh, my gosh. I am truly the luckiest guy.
All right. We're going to take this up the next time. I want you to get to at least page 50. Okay. We can look for you on ESPN, spouting your wisdom about the 2007-2008 season all year.
Let's rock.
All right. Thanks for coming out. Really appreciate it.
Wake up to find out that you, Bill Simmons, are indeed the eyes of the world.
Take care.
So I get to sign off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.